My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak to the senior enlisted advisor. We talk about his early career, deploying on operations around the world, and his current role. We discuss his own mental health challenges and why he's so passionate about making things better for those that serve. An MOD special, Glenn Horton. This is Declassified. So born in 1972, just outside of Cambridge, was you an only child?
Yeah, only child. No siblings. Grew up in a council house, in a small cul-de-sac, in a little rural village south of Cambridge.
Yeah. And what was childhood like growing up?
I had a good childhood. It was humble. It was, mid-70s for me as a young kid. Good parents, brought me up very well. Although, you know, we didn't have much, like many families didn't in the mid-70s. But yeah, I was looked after well. I had a fun childhood, nothing extravagant, but it was just, you know, I did various things. I loved sport. I got involved in, you know, various clubs like the Cubs and the Scouts, and touched a little bit on cadets, and did a little bit of boxing training when I was a small kid. In the local boxing club. But no, I had a good upbringing, and I'm really grateful for the way my parents brought me up and the values they taught me and the manners they taught me and just how to be a good human being.
What did your mum and dad do?
So my mum did lots of different jobs, from sort of secretarial work to working in shops, and then she worked at a local, there was like a local greenhouse sales factory that she worked in for a long period of time. And my father was a bus driver since the time I can remember. Still a bus driver now.
Is he?
Yeah.
Still in the same place?
Yeah, still in the same area, yeah.
Yeah. Was you good at school then?
No. Not because, it was mostly because I didn't apply myself. So I didn't like school. I didn't enjoy it. I had some good friends. I suppose I wasn't in the popular group, but I wasn't in the non-popular group. I was sort of, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of kid, but I just didn't apply myself. I just couldn't be bothered. I was a daydreamer, didn't listen, didn't pay attention, was more worried about cricket and rugby and sport and PT and, you know, like many boys do at that sort of age. So I didn't really pay as much attention as I should do. Consequently, you know, towards the end of my schooling years, I realised that it just wasn't for me, and I wasn't going to come out of there with anything significant. So my education suffered because of my attitude towards it, really.
What's the options then? Because, like, coming from Hull, my options were stay in Hull, dead-end job, or join the military.
Yeah, I mean,
that's what I felt like.
I thought about all that. Yeah, as you do. You do your options at school, don't you? And as it used to be, the third year, and I had no idea where I was going to go. I probably would have ended up doing something like being a car mechanic or something in the local community. I just had no idea at that stage. All I did know was that I had this sort of draw towards the military. I had my grandparents had served RAF and Army, and there was something there. And I grew up in a time when, so when I was about 10 years old, the Falklands was ongoing. So, you know, I used to collect the binder folders and soldier magazines and survival aid stuff and mercenaries. You know, I was just interested in it, and I always wanted to do it, but I never worked out which part of it I wanted to go into.
Joined at 15.
Yeah, so as soon as I could, I went to the career office, because I think they give you like 15 years and 9 months. You could apply back then. It was a long time ago now, but. Yeah, I literally went to the careers office on the first day that I could and walked in there and said that I want to join the army.
Yeah. And did you know what part you was going to join?
I had no idea. So, in the 80s, there was a famous, as it was then, documentary on the paras. And I think they must have had an influx of people wanting to join the parachute regiment at that time. So I went in there and said, look, I want to join the army, I want to join the paras. And they must have looked me up and down and thought, not a chance, son. You know, you weigh about 6 stone and you haven't got a parachute regiment in you. So I wouldn't even bother, either that or they're over-recruited. So that was a no. And then they said, what else? And I said, oh, what about the Scots Guards? Because I see a poster on the wall, and they said, are you Scottish? And I went, well, no, I'm from Cambridge. And they said, have you got any Scottish family? And I was like, no, none at all. And they were like, well, you can't join the Scots Guards in. So they then said, pretty much, I think I was boring them, but they pretty much said, look, you need to make a decision. What do you want to go into? And I just genuinely had no idea. I was a kid. And I just thought, I said to him, my name begins with G, so I'll go for something beginning with G. And they said Green Jackets or Grenadier Guards. And that was it. I then signed up to the Grenadier Guards, went literally across the road on Mill Road in Cambridge, had a cough and drop from a doctor, and did my barb test, which was like, it was literally a handwritten test then, you know, a bit of maths, a little bit of English. And I was quite proud of myself. I was only qualified to either blow a trumpet in a band or join the infantry. So, I joined the infantry, and that was the start of this 31-year journey.
The thought process of a 15-year-old
boy. Yeah, I was quite proud of myself the way I sort of narrowed it down.
Where did you go then? Out, do you remember how long it was then between coffin drop to getting on a bus or getting off a bus?
I think I joined literally in the May, and by the mid-June, I was at going to the depot, the guards depot in Pirbright. And I just remember it was my first solo journey on a train. I'd never been on a journey, you know, I've never been on a train on my own before. And I got on this train with a bag, you know, as per the packing list you'd been thrown. This was after doing the Sutton Coldfield thing you used to do, the 2.5 dayer. I literally turned up at Brookwood Station, not having a clue what I was letting myself into with this bag, and just got met by the scariest looking sort of sergeant I'd ever met in my life. Got thrown on a bus, and that was when the year's training started at the infamous Guards Depot in the late 80s.
You was a junior leader then?
Yeah. And then, apparently they thought I had some some potential skills for a junior leader, but I'm not entirely convinced, because I never managed to pull out any of the education stuff they wanted me to during that year.
Yeah. What was the year like then? What did you do?
I mean, this was late 80s, and this was, if you can think of phase one and phase two now, as most of your listeners will understand it, it was that all combined in a wanna. So I literally arrived there in June 88 and left there in June 89, and you went from the very basics of training all the way through to the point of passing out. So it was a full year of training, but it was intense. There was no, you know, back then there was no, not as much thought process and duty of care as put into training nowadays, you know, health and safety, all that sort of stuff. It was just, it was a beasting for a year. It really was, from start to finish. But, you know, I look back on it with really fond memories. I met some amazing instructors, or experienced some amazing instructors. I experienced some awful instructors, and it's a year that will stay with me for the rest of my life. I can remember so much of it like it was yesterday. So it had a real impact on me as a person, as a human being, and as a soldier. It's genuinely carved out what I was going to be in the future. I had a lot to learn from there, but it was the start of my journey.
Mm. With you all the young soldiers there, all the junior leaders, were they 15, 16?
Yeah, so it was literally the Harrogate of the day, really, if you're a junior leader. And, I mean, I was in Waterloo 3 platoon, and actually the garrison sergeant major now of London District, me and him were in the same platoon, and we're still going now this far on. But, we were all kids, literally kids.
Yeah, and then a kid then going to Munster in 89, what was the experience?
Yeah, so I got posted to 1st Battalion Grenadier Guards, who were in Munster, Germany. So that was another whole experience. So going from my first train journey to then going on my first sort of overseas journey on a posting. Got to Munster. The battalion at the time was deployed on exercise in Canada. So I joined a company called the Queen's Company, which is still a well-known company in the Household Division now, purely because every single member of the company is over 6 foot. So you can imagine me turning up weighing 76 kilos, about 6'3" in the late 80s. And I got put on, I remember getting put on the bus that had to go and pick up the company that was returning from Canada from exercise as this day one crow. And I was sat at the front, and I just remember getting on the bus and these honking bods just turning up, getting off the plane, staring at me, you know, almost growling at me, getting onto the transport. And I was petrified as a young I suppose I was still 16 then. And anyway, the bus journey sort of took us back to Oxford Barracks in Munster. And I just remember getting abused the whole way back, about a 2-hour journey, and having oranges thrown at me and water bottles. And you can just imagine, because I was a junior bod, and this was my kind of sort of third or fourth day in battalion. And I thought, oh my God, is this the way it's going to go? Is this what my career is going to be like in this battalion? Mm. And so I've gone from, you know, having a sparkle in my eye and being massively proud of joining the regiment that I joined, going through this year of sort of hell to become the soldier I wanted to become. And then you get treated like that at the very start of your career. You kind of think, God, is this really what I want to do? Mm. I mean, it's a long time ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it is what it is. But yeah. Was you ever homesick at that point?
No, I was never homesick, to be honest. I couldn't wait to get away from home. Not because of my mum and dad or my family sort of makeup, because that was great. I liked living at home, but I was bored. You know, I was a kid and I wanted to travel the world and I wanted to go and experience something new and do something different, hence why I joined the army.
Mm. And that first year in, did it get better?
Not initially. I mean, back in those days, physical bullying was rife. I think wherever you went around the army. And my first year was particularly awful. I don't know if it was because I was deemed as a bit of a gobshite or a little bit cocksure of myself, or I don't know what it was, but certain people took a dislike to me. And some of the beasting and some of the physical punishments and bullying then was something to behold. You know, I never even knew it was physically possible to jump out of a third floor window with a Shamuli parachute while you're naked, or to be, you know, stripped naked and covered in graphite grease and thrown in a skip. You don't expect to do that when you first join, but it was kind of like the norm for new people to be treated like that. And I was treated bad for a year until you sort of get your status. And my status sort of came, I sort of made my name when we deployed to the first Gulf, which was, you know, deploying to war at the time. But it took me a good year to settle in. Don't get me wrong, I met some amazing people, friends for life, but the experience was a challenge.
Mm.
And it was a sort of time where I just, you know, I was like, do I really want to do this? Do I want to get treated like this? When's it going to stop? And how long does this go on for? And it happened to everybody, but I just, that for me was my point. That was my lesson in life, to make sure that I never, ever did anything like that to another human being. And I never did.
I was just about to say that. Did that then, I was about to, well, you've answered the question, but did it go on beyond that? Did your peers carry that on?
Oh yeah, it carried on. Yeah, it was just like a cycle of life. It was, you know, new guys would join and they get all the hard time and they get the bullying, and eventually the physical stuff sort of dwindled and phased out because it was just a societal thing. But I just never made a point of doing it. So when the new guys used to come in, then I'd make a point of not necessarily making friends with them, but making them feel comfortable and making them feel welcome. And I've always been the same, you know. Don't get me wrong, I've not always treated people like they're my best friend or they're a good person all the time. But I've never bullied, and I've never physically laid hands on people or done stuff that I shouldn't have done. I've wanted to treat people the way I wanted to be treated.
How old was you when you went to the Gulf?
So I think I just turned 18. So you had to be 17 and a half to go on operations or go to war then. And I think at the time the youngest guy was a soldier in the Scottish Division in the Royal Scots, and I think I was probably, I don't know, second or third sort of next junior bod or senior bod. I was just 18.
And what was it like going, as in like just that little bit before, as a youngster, especially talking to your mother and father? Do you remember that kind of pre-deployment?
It was a whirlwind, to be honest. It came around really quick. All of a sudden, we were just told that we were going to go and deploy to, on Operation Granby, as it was called. So the US version side of it was Desert Storm. We were on Operation Granby. And we just got told, hey, we're deploying. We're going to go to war. First Gulf kicked off. It was all really quick because of the timelines. So we had to do pre-deployment training pretty rapid. A lot of, you know, rifle ranges and fitness and nuclear, biological, chemical stuff to get us ready. And our battalion was split up into different regiments, which was a bit of a shame, but our company group was attached to the Royal Scots battle group. And it just came around really quick, and I just remember that I think we went on the New Year's Day, I think, if I remember rightly. We deployed on New Year's Day, so I had Christmas at home with my family. And when you're 18, I kind of didn't really care. I wasn't bothered if I was going to war. It didn't really make much difference to me. And I remember in the lines, we were packing our boxes and singing stupid songs and writing death letters to our mums. And I think I recorded a tape, leaving my will on my tape. You know, it was a joke to us. I'm sure it wasn't to my mother and father, but you know, it was a life experience. It was something new, something different, and something I was excited to be a part of.
What were you doing out there then?
So, if I'm completely honest, when you're an 18-year-old guardsman back in the day and you deploy to war, I'm not entirely sure I knew much of what I was doing, whether that was down to passive communication or whether that was down to I didn't really care. And, you know, you think what you want to think when you're 18 years old. We literally got out there. We did a lot of training in country because we were armoured, so we were in Warriors. So you can imagine the brotherhood and the camaraderie straight away in your group of people, in your warrior and in your section, all of whom I can still remember to this day like it was yesterday. We trained for the best part of, it was a number of weeks. And then we, you know, it's a distant memory to me now, but we literally went through a series of operations, a series of lines of departure and a series of assaults, which weren't always quite what we expected them to be. Some were kinetic, some weren't. It was just amazing to be in the back of a warrior as literally, you know, a new adult, as an 18-year-old, listening to the combined arms do what they do. So listening to, even from the inside of a warrior, hearing aircraft do what they do, hearing the tanks going before us, you know, the armoured corps and the cavalry doing what they had to do to the enemy before the infantry got in there in a warrior. It was a real learning curve for me. And then to, you know, to get out of the back of a warrior, going into war, into a section attack as an 18-year-old with your mates, knowing the only people you've got with you on your left and your right, the six or seven people in the back of your wagon, was a real experience. And going to war then and going to the first Gulf is very different to subsequent operations for me. It was different to go into Iraq and different going to Afghanistan. It was just a different type of operation. We were generally going to war and we didn't know if we were going to come back. We didn't know what we were going into. Whereas when you go on subsequent tours of Herrick, which many of your listeners will have done, you know what you're going to. So it was a new experience.
Was you actually fighting then on the first Gulf War?
So the first Gulf War, I think a lot of people don't quite understand what happened. Some people had more fighting than others, depends on what regiment and what area you were in. But in a lot of cases, there was a lot of surrendering by enemy forces. So by the time we got there, most of the time you ended up doing prisoner of war handling. But yeah, you know, there was some kinetic stuff. There was, you know, tanks, certainly the armour corps, warriors, chain guns were firing, and there was section attacks and foxholes to clear, etc. But it wasn't that much, certainly where I was. I can't speak for others because obviously there was other operations going on, special forces, etc. But in my little warrior and in my company group and in my battalion or battle group I was part of, it wasn't what we were expecting. It wasn't what we expected it to be, which, you know, in the end of it, it was a good thing.
When you came back, it wasn't long before then you was off to Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And you was a Lance Corporal by that time.
Yeah, so we got back, we got about 91, I did my Lance Corporal's course. I was actually going to get out of the army. I didn't. Oh, it wasn't for me. I didn't like it at that stage. I'd had enough. And I remember I'd terminated and I was leaving. And I think I was due to be out of the army on a Monday. And I remember my company sergeant major at the time got me in and said, what are you doing on Sunday? I said, I'm getting out of the army on Monday, sir. And he said, you know what, you're going on a corporal's course. And I just remember inside thinking, is this bloke for real? I'm getting out of the army. I've had enough of this. And I was genuinely ordered to go on a corporal's course. So I went on the corporal's course. It was done at Purbright, you know, back into the bear pit of Purbright, the old guards depot. I did my corporal's course and weirdly did really well and came top on it. And it changed my journey, changed my path. I refound my sort of love for the military and for my regiment and the army, and then I'm still here now, however many years later. So yeah, it was probably a good decision for my company's major, although I didn't agree with it at the time.
And that's when then you went to Northern Ireland.
Yeah, so first tour of Northern Ireland came up, and my company group was going to Crossmaglen, but I actually went for, so it was a South Armagh tour, which in those days was, you know, this was early 90s, this was still bandit country. It was the punchiest operation you could go on at the time, particularly in the South Armagh. But I went for selection for the close observation platoon. So that was like a long old selection to get into that. And it was a, you know, it was a prestige sort of little group, almost like a recce platoon back in the day of close observation Northern Ireland. So I did that on that first tour, and it was immense. I learned some great skills on that, and I loved doing it. It was a real good experience.
What was you then with the IRA still obviously really active?
Oh yeah,
was you close by to them? Like, what was?
Yeah, so the I've got, you know, people that have done Northern Ireland and Afghanistan and other operations, you know, might have the same thought process as me, but sometimes in Northern Ireland I was more scared than I was in Afghanistan. And people that haven't been to Northern Ireland wouldn't understand that or believe that, but when you're going into an area that is, you know, your country, it's the United Kingdom, and you are dealing with your own people, and they are your enemy, and you don't know who they are or where they are, and you're patrolling around rural locations where there are known snipers patrolling the area with, you know, 0.5 Barrett sniper rifles, it's pretty scary. And these sort of areas in Northern Ireland were small, and sometimes you had limited areas where you could go, and pattern setting was could be a problem. So it took some tactics and some thought process and some, you know, some good infantry skills to try and avoid that sort of stuff. But it was, you know, it, the tours were punchy, and they were relatively, you know, there was a fear factor there, most certainly. And you had the IED fear factor as well. So yeah, it was always in the back of your mind on those tours. And it differed depending on what area you went to in Northern Ireland. It was very different. And I did a few tours in different areas.
But the lads getting, were lads getting hit and were lads getting killed?
It wasn't, you know, this, don't get me wrong, this wasn't like going through daily IED belts in Afghanistan. It's not the same. And it was a lot less frequent. But, you know, some of the reps you'd get contacts. It depends on the area you were in, but you could have daily small arms contacts. You could have weekly mortar attacks onto some of the SF bases you were in. IEDs could be weekly. You know, I can't put a time frame on it because it depended on the area, and some areas were more kinetic than others. But you really had to be on top of your game when you were serving on those tours.
We've never heard anyone talk about Northern Ireland yet on this. Was there a feeling that, you know, the British troops were doing some good there? Did you ever get that, even on reflection now? Did you feel like you was doing
It's a hard one to comment on, really, because it depends on the areas you're in, and it depended on the political and the religious sort of denominations in that area.
What about you, though? Did you feel like when you was there, you was doing something good then? I'll rephrase it then. Well, as a young soldier, did you feel like you was there for a reason?
To be honest, I didn't really think about it.
Okay.
I was young, and you just did what you were told to do, and you followed orders, and you listened to orders, and you did what you had to do. And you trust in your chain of command, and you trust in your government, and you trust in the people that have put you there in the first place. So for me personally, I never thought, should I be here? And I never put any real thought process into whether or not I was achieving any good. I just did what I was told to do, and I did it to the best of my ability.
After that tour, you've already mentioned, and you went back, did once more, was it?
I did.
You posted there?
Well, I did a couple more tours. I did the first year of a 2-year tour in Ballykinla, which was a residential tour for the whole battalion. But I only did the first year there, and that was as a traditional rifle company, sort of multiple commander, which again was in the sort of, a lot of the stuff was in the Armagh area around marching season. So there was more public order stuff there as opposed to IEDs and kinetic stuff, which was again another interesting experience. But I did a year there because I then went and did junior Brecon section commander's course in 1995.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Well, just explain what junior Brecon is.
So for an infantry guy, your promotion courses are essentially, you do your Lance Corporal's course first, which you've already touched on. You then go and do junior Brecon if you're a rifle company. this is if you aren't mortars or anti-tanks or a speciality. If you're a rifle company guy, you do junior Brecon, and it's 12 weeks. 6 weeks will be tactics and 6 weeks will be skill at arms. And it's where you essentially learn your trade and you learn to be to become a commander, literally to command a section of people. And, you know, it's a rite of passage for those in the infantry. It's a tough test. I didn't excel on my junior Brecon because I found it really hard. I'd been essentially the best part of 5 years as a part of a public duties battalion in London. So I'd done a couple of island tours, a couple of sort of overseas exercises, but essentially I'd been marching up and down the Mall wearing a tunic and bearskin. So I wasn't, you know, in the right mindset to do junior Brecon. And I also didn't understand the bigger picture that there was other people outside of my own regiment in the infantry. So I was quite naive. So I went on it and didn't do as well as I wanted to do. And again, it made me question whether or not I wanted to stay in. I passed it. Became a section commander and then went off to Catterick thereafter to practice my trade as a section commander with recruits. But it's a tough test, and it's something the infantry are very proud of, and it's something that we take very seriously, and it is literally, as I said, a rite of passage for us.
I didn't realise the extent of it until probably speaking to Brian Wood and then definitely Sean Jones, and how it upskills people
to a
different level and for different professionalism. So after that, then it's senior Brecon, which you did in 2000.
I sort of redeemed myself on seniors. It was completely different me. I'd learnt so much, and I think the experience I learnt as a section commander, I kind of found my feet, and because you're constantly learning, right? When you're in the army, especially when you're a non-commissioned officer, you learn off other people, you learn how to treat people, you learn what's right and what's wrong, and I constantly strive to better myself. And then when I went on seniors in 2000, it just all worked out well for me, and I did well on seniors, and I came off that and was literally promoted the day I got back by my commanding officer to set an example. And it worked out all right for me. So the day I got back, I was turned into a platoon sergeant. And then, the trajectory sort of started from there on in. I was, you know, that was the point where I considered doing other things. You know, I was fit, I was strong, I was confident in my ability. I felt like a good platoon sergeant. I considered doing, you know, special forces selection, but chose not to do it because I didn't think I'd be able to commit to it as much as I would have liked to do, because I was such a family man and I didn't want to, you know, lose time with my family. And I know that, you know, Special Forces is a big commitment and a lot of time away. So, yeah, I found my feet and I was in a good place. And that's when I really knew that I wanted to stay in for the long haul and make something in the career.
When you go senior Brecon,
yeah,
because it's so far removed from anything we did, the senior Brecon... Again, is that all infantry?
Yeah, so it's the same. It's not the same again. It's another step up, if you like. It's another 12 weeks. And again, you do skill at arms, but you learn your range qualifications, you know, to run field firing ranges, get called up in that. But you also do the tactics. But when you do the tactics, you do all the different phases of operations. You do defence, you do fibula, you do attack week, you do patrols week, you do the fan dance. And it's a real tough gig, but you don't just do qualifications to become a platoon sergeant. You also do appointments as platoon commander as well. So there's a lot of pressure on you. There's not much time. There's not much sleep, and it's hard graft.
Is it a learning course though, or is it a beasting course?
No, I think it's a mix of both. I certainly learned a lot. You learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about other people. You learn a lot of life skills off it. And it helps to build your mental resilience, it helps to build your physical resilience, and it helps you put you in a position to be able to lead and command those that you are employed to look after.
So a lot of, I'll just get what I'm getting there, a lot of stress, a lot of bit of suffering.
Yeah.
But off the back of that, you're making decisions, you're learning some, obviously, tactics and everything else.
It is an amazing course. And I mean, I did that a long time ago.
Because that was
now it'll be even better.
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, like 2000, way before Iraq and Afghanistan, so all the stuff.
Yeah, this was all conventional. This was, when I did it, it was a conventional platoon sergeant's battle course.
And so after that, you didn't go on TELIC?
No, so not a later Tellec I went on.
Yeah, not Tellec 1, though. You didn't go on that. You was in...
No, I didn't do that.
Okay.
So did platoon sergeant's battle course. Then I became a platoon sergeant. I did a couple of overseas exercises as a platoon sergeant, some public duties again. And then I didn't really... there was no operations then because I then did the Sandhurst Carder, which is a four-week Carder course run at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst to become a colour sergeant instructor because we are probably one of the only armies in the world where non-commissioned officers help to train officers. So every year the Sandhurst Carder runs for, I don't know, approximately 60 sergeants and colour sergeants that aspire to become instructors at Sandhurst and teach officers. And, you know, 50% of those will kind of get through depending on the year and how many they need to then train officers for a 2-year period. And it's, you know, it's a great place to go. Some people choose not to do it. Some people choose to go to Brecon and other establishments where they can teach people. But it was something I chose to do and was sort of like pushed towards. And yeah, I got in there and spent a fantastic 2 years as a colour sergeant instructor and I loved it.
Is it just guards?
No, it's all arms actually.
Oh, is it?
Used to be very guards heavy. You talk 60s, 70s, around that, there was a lot. It was very heavily influenced by the foot guards, but not so much now. There's still, you know, quite a few guardsmen there and some of the old positions there, adjutantal positions and sergeant major positions are still guards for ceremonial reasons. But it's now open to pretty much anybody, which I think is a good thing. And you get all sorts. You get sappers in there, you get gunners, you get signallers. Anybody can go for it. But it's a tough test. It's a tough 4 weeks, mentally more than anything else, because you're in competition against other people.
And then I'm assuming then it's prestigious to be there.
Oh, it's amazing.
Do you feel...
It is fantastic. I mean, I've been there 3 times. It is absolutely fantastic. And I mean, I had a great run there. I had a platoon all the way through, because sometimes you'll have a platoon, sometimes you won't, and you're working the skill at arms wing, teaching other sort of skills. But I was lucky to have a platoon all the way through. And one of my particular platoons, I was lucky enough to have Prince Harry as one of my cadets. So you can imagine, as a young colour sergeant, it was just a fantastic experience for me.
Yeah. What was that like? Was the... actually, something I wasn't really going to discuss, but like, what was there more pressure on you then with someone like Harry in the platoon?
Yeah, but only through administrative purposes and reasons, because you know, clearly when you've got a member of the royal family and establishment, there's going to be interest from media, and there's support staff that have to, you know, play a part in looking after a member of the royal family. But to be honest, Sandhurst were brilliant. My training team were brilliant. Prince Harry and his staff were brilliant, and it was pretty seamless.
So they have staff with them?
Well, with the protection officers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ah. But did he get treated differently?
No, exactly the same. Lived the same, ate the same, worked the same, shouted at the same, ran the same, everything.
So the protection blokes, no, would never step in and stop shouting at him?
No, you wouldn't. Same as, you'd never know. So it was easy, and it was good fun, and it was a real life experience.
Do you,
for him, I think, just as much.
Yeah, well, he, look where he is now. Do you, at that stage, do you get bonds with the recruits coming through, those junior officers?
Definitely, yeah, so you have a platoon of about 30, roughly. Mm. And they come from all different walks of life, literally different walks of life. And you get a lot of overseas cadets as well. And every, I mean, I had about 5 platoons in total. In fact, that's a lie. When I was a colour sergeant, I had about 3 platoons. But then the subsequent times, even as a company major, you have, you know, a close bond with the platoons that come through. But the platoons I had there as a colour sergeant were all very different for different reasons. And you get some real characters. And now, having been there 3 times, I know so many officers now around the British Army. It's just unbelievable. Everywhere you go, you just bump into people that either don't want to speak to you, would love to speak to you, or would, you know, scuttle past you and not like to remind you of Sandhurst days. Yeah. So, no, it's brilliant. It was great fun. I absolutely loved it.
Do you still know Prince Harry now then?
Yeah. So, and it's not just Prince Harry as well. You know, I've got good relationships with a lot of my old cadets from a long time ago that we've stayed in touch with. But yeah, I know Prince Harry, and we still... work together, collaborate from time to time. for the good and benefit of serving and veteran personnel.
Yeah, I think that's what Mo was getting at, was that, because obviously we'll get onto where you're at now, but there's obviously a clear link between what he's doing now and what you're doing now. But yeah, before we get there, 2006, you went back as a company sergeant major.
So I finished as a colour sergeant in 2006 and then went straight onto the back end of a telec tour with my battalion. And then once I finished the telec tour, which was pretty underwhelming, to be honest, I mean, it was at the back end of it, and the job we did wasn't that enjoyable. But anyway, we came back from telec, and then I did my normal company sergeant major duties in my battalion, and then went back to Sandhurst again on a sort of second tour company sergeant major job from 2008 to 2010.
Well, when was your first Herrick?
My first Herrick was 2007.
So was that in between?
Yeah, so during that, yeah. So I finished in 2006, went to telec, finished telec, and then went straight on to MST, mission-specific training for Herrick 6. So before I went back to Sandhurst in 2008, I had a Herrick 6 in between as company sergeant major.
And what's it like then? What's the difference then? Because obviously you've done company sergeant major on a telec.
Yeah.
Obviously the back end.
Yeah.
And then going straight into company sergeant major on a Herrick.
It was different because we were... So when we were on telec, doing the job we were doing, we were watching 16 Brigade on Herrick 4. And yeah. I don't know if you remember, the listeners remember, you know, that was a very kinetic period. They were in their platoon houses in Sangin and Nowzad and Musakala, all those sort of places. And for us to watch, we were like, oh God, we wish we were not on telec and we wish we were in Herrick. And before we knew it, we found out we were going to leave telec, go straight on to mission-specific training, and we were going to go out on Herrick 6. So there was the five between us, Herrick 5, whilst we were doing our training. Then we deployed on that as part of the OMAL team, so the Operational Mentoring Liaison team, and that's what our battalion did, which was a fascinating tour. And to be a company sergeant major, part of that group, although the battalion was... spread to the four winds a little bit, because the OMLT, you had to reduce your company size into mentoring teams to look after the Afghans. And the best part of our battalion formed the Brigade Recce Force at the time, and also a company we called Number 3 Company that worked in Garmseer, which was a bigger company group, and they had a really punchy tour on Herrick 6. So for us as an OMLT, for me as a company major, it was kind of sad because I didn't have a full company group. But it was kind of good as well, because we had a select few non-commissioned officers, mostly mentoring teams to look after the Afghans. So it was a very interesting, exciting, and sort of a mixed emotion tour.
Did you lose anyone on that?
Yeah. So I mean, our company group, the battalion, lost five of our guys on that tour, There was a lot of injuries on that tour. My company group had a lot of injuries for various reasons. And I mean, then it was very different to the latter Herricks. It was very kinetic. There was less IEDs. There was much more gunfighting, if you like, and a lot more vehicle patrols and clearing fobs and compounds and stuff like that. So there was a lot of injuries, and when you've got a small OMLT team and you're losing people quite quickly to varying injuries, then it's quite hard to then maintain the sort of the manpower you need to manage the Afghans.
I won't go into it too much, but at this point you've got two children.
Yeah.
Your oldest son is probably well aware of what's going on, because he's about 10?
Yeah, he was then, yeah.
Does that play...
Oh yeah, massively. You know, for anyone that hasn't been on operations or doesn't understand that is listening to these podcasts, going on operations is very hard to describe what impact that has on a family. Mm. You can't describe to people what it's like to say goodbye to your family, to your wife and to your children, knowing there's a good chance that you might never come back. You can't explain that. You've got to live it. To really understand it. So you can imagine what farewells are like. And when you've got, you know, it's bad enough without children, but when you've got children, you know, it's properly heart-wrenching saying goodbye to kids, wondering whether you're ever going to see him again. So, and I just remember on that, I mean, my son was at a really influential age for a father-son relationship. And on that tour in particular, I mean, on that tour, we were out on the ground for the best part of 80 days at one period of time.
All right.
So it was a busy tour, and everybody that's been on operations will know what I mean when I say that everybody has a day of days that sticks with them forever. And one of the days on that 80-day operation we were on was the worst day of my tour, the toughest day, and it just happened to be my son's birthday. And it's hard, well, it's not hard to apply yourself because we're professional and we do what we do, but when stuff like that is in the back of your mind, trying to separate your the emotional part of your mind and concentrate on what the task you've got to do and what you've got to do is can be difficult.
Mm.
So it's an emotional roller coaster. And then when you come back, you know, and the euphoria of, you know, when you're lucky enough to come back with your life or without injury, you can only imagine what other people go through. But the euphoria you get when you see your family and you see your kids and they're happy that you're home. And it's the wider family as well. You know, it's parents and grandparents and uncles and, you know, everyone's affected by it.
Mm. Is it then euphoria? Is it that euphoria? Do you ever, what's the word? Let me get the wording right here. That initial euphoria, then yeah. do you miss it?
So
when you're home,
I think the best way, yeah, it is initial euphoria. You know, to get home is amazing because you have high expectations. So your wife and your kids will have high expectations. You will have high expectations because any communications you've had on operations is all geared around getting home and getting back and what you're going to do and how amazing life's going to be and changes you're going to make. Because you reflect a lot when you're on operations, you know, both sides of the family do. The way I always describe coming back from operations is when you are on ops and, it, you know, everyone deals with it differently and you deal with situations differently. I find operations as quite a simple existence. And what I mean by that is not the fact that your life's at danger and your soldiers' lives are at danger and you've got to manage that and lead people and command people through that on a tour. I mean, you've all got to look after your mates. You've got to look after your vehicle, your Bergen, your rifle, your food. You know, it's simple. You get up, you operate, you go to bed. If you get to bed. You know what I mean? It's just a cycle. Yeah. You know what you're doing. You know where you are. There's a routine there. And when you get back, well, I mean, firstly, your family don't have that routine. Your family are paying bills. They're dealing with the stress of life. They're doing school runs. They're getting the car fixed. They're getting the drains unblocked. They're doing all the crap that we get away with. You know, we've got our own crap to deal with, but it's just different. So you haven't got the life stresses and pressures other than being separated from your family. So I enjoy the simple existence. And when you get back and you get over that euphoria of seeing everybody, that's when I think everybody in their own way misses being in operations, whether it's the excitement, whether it's the simple existence, whether it's the camaraderie, whether it's the brotherhood you've formed, whether it's the fighting, whether it's, I don't know what it is, different people that do it different ways. But I just, yeah, when you get back, the excitement soon goes back to normal. And I think that's when some people start to struggle with the change in environment and, you know, going back to normal daily jogging.
Mm. Did you ever, like, have any fluctuation in it?
I suppose, one example, I just remember getting back, everything was fantastic, really happy, all great. Didn't really miss being on operations at this point. I was still in, you know, post-operational tour leave. I was quite happy to be there and not shaving and wearing my flip-flops and just chilling out. But I do distinctly remember doing the washing up one day. By the way, I hadn't washed up for the best part of eight. It was a bit of a shock to come back and start doing stuff like washing up. That's my point, though. It's your wife and your family have got to do that all the time. But I was washing up and a teaspoon literally went down in between the plastic bowl and the sink and I couldn't get the teaspoon out. And it got, I can't remember exactly how it, but it stressed me out to the point where I wanted to smash the crap out of the plastic bowl. Yeah. So it was like it was just little things would frustrate me.
Mm.
Small things. You know, you hit your head on the cupboard door, you would react differently to what you used to react when you hit the head on the cupboard door. So it wasn't the stress of operations, maybe. I don't know what it was. It was just, I was having to deal with crap that I couldn't be bothered to deal with.
Do you think the world view would change? Because as you were speaking, I've heard this again and again, actually, yeah. where it's the little things that would annoy you, whereas the big picture stuff, the important stuff, yeah. is you're much more relaxed about. Like if something was to happen to somebody, you're in a much better position to deal with it. Do you know what I mean? If one of the kids went got taken to hospital with a with a cut, you can deal with that.
Yeah, you can deal with it. Yeah, it's the small things. Yeah, it's the small things. And I think what I also found and what changed me as well was my my emotional mindset. So I've always, you know, prided myself on being a stiff upper lip type of, you know, good old British guy that doesn't cry about stuff or get emotional. But I just found that after that first tour, I just got emotional about things I never would have got emotional about before. And I really remember going to watch genuinely a kid's movie with my family. And even the kid's movie put a lump in my throat the size of an ostrich egg.
Mm.
And I was like, what's the matter with you? What are you getting? And it wasn't because I had issues. It was because I just valued everything I had more. Because you've been in the situation and you've seen other people less fortunate than you on operations, and because you know what could happen to you and how things could have panned out, you just think about life differently.
Mm.
You think about your family differently, and you don't take things for granted.
After that, the company sergeant major at Sandhurst.
Yeah.
Post that, you was RSM back with the Grenadier Guards.
Yeah.
Was that... almost pinnacle.
Yeah, I mean, for me, for a lot of soldiers, I think you get to a point. I mean, my point where as I mentioned before, when I got to that sort of platoon sergeant level, that's when I used to look at my regimental sergeant majors, and you know, many of them now are still my good friends and role models and mentors. And I would have loved to have done it. So to get it, to be selected as the regimental sergeant major of my battalion was just amazing, and I was immensely proud to be appointed into that role, and I absolutely loved it.
What kind of stuff are you doing then? Maybe ceremonial?
Well, when I took over, we were literally getting ready to go on Herrick again, onto Herrick 16. Because when I was in Afghanistan, I'd missed our battalion's middle tour of Herrick. And so I came in literally as we were prepping and doing mission-specific training again. We're in Canada for a couple of exercises before we then deployed in 2012 on Herrick 16.
Mm.
And then we did Herrick 16, and then thereafter I did a little bit of public duties before I handed that job over.
Herrick 16, then, as RSM.
Yeah.
What is the role? Are you in an office? Are you in ops room? What are you doing?
I mean, the battalion was split, so it was back to the sort of Goreshk area for me, which was the same as Herrick 6, which was weird, mixed emotions to go back and see how much it had developed and changed, but also going back to the place where you'd fought so hard for and seen people get injured and killed. It was just bizarre going back, you know, a good few years later. But my role then was very different to the one on Herrick 6. There was a little bit of, you know, office, battle group sort of headquarters in Fob Price, as it was in Goreshk at the time. But mostly it was... being part of the TAC group, it was planning and moving the commanding officer around with our small group to all the outstations and the FOBs and the locations the guys were at, to make sure that we could have the battalion function in the way they should be on operations. So it was, but it was a different environment. You know, we had vehicles we could have only have dreamed for on Herrick 6. Mm. So you felt a lot safer in the vehicles you were in. But the level of IEDs and stuff for me, having missed the middle tour of Herrick, was just completely different to what I'd known in 2007. So, you know, the route planning and all the stuff you've got to pay meticulous attention to look after your guys played a big part in my role because I was travelling around so much. But the battalion company groups were in set locations for the best part of the tour, and they had a tough tour.
What, as in getting attacked? So
we had a couple of companies that were in two locations in the Goreshk area, and then we had another company that was doing a lot of ground taking and ground holding. Because this particular area around Adin Zai and Rahim Kalay and Karnikar and the Goreshk area always been, you know, Taliban strongholds. They just had a rough tour, really rough tour, ranging from IEDs to kinetic to, you know, UGLs in compounds to, you kind of name it. It wasn't what I was expecting on a tour so late on in the campaign, if that makes sense. So it was...
Was morale down?
I mean, when you're getting hammered by UGLs and IEDs and people are getting injured and people are getting killed, then there are going to be periods of time where morale is down. But, you know, the resilience and the toughness of soldiers never fails. And the camaraderie, brotherhood, the stuff I've mentioned all the way through this podcast is what keeps the guys going. And it's what kept the battalion going.
And from your point of view then, as one of, like you said, like that pinnacle, everyone's looking to you.
Yeah.
Does it ever affect you in command when lads are dying or getting injured? Do you ever feel responsible for it? Or
is it? You do. I mean, it's slightly different as a regimental sergeant major because you are not the commanding officer. You are not the company commander. So as a regimental sergeant major, you don't actually own anything. You're not actually in command because that's what our officers do. We're there to complement the chain of command. But, you know, as soon as you, and many listeners will remember it, as soon as you hear a crump or you are stood in the ops room and you hear something come in, then you can't help but get that sinking feeling. And then, you know, the urge to find out what's going on because you care about your blokes and you want everyone to be okay. And you just want information, you want to know where they are and what's going on and how you can help. So, yeah. There were testing times on that tour, like all the tours, where you just wish you could make everything better, but you haven't got a magic wand and you can't change everything or make everything better, no matter what position you're in. So it does take its toll on people in command and leadership positions. There's no doubt about that, but you've got to deal with it. Everyone deals with it in their own way, I suppose.
I suppose everyone's got their own little bit of stress.
It was my job as a regimental sergeant major, and I've prided myself on... I've grown up in an environment, an infantry environment, alpha male dominated, macho. You know, it's the job of the regimental sergeant major to tell everyone it's all going to be all right and to make light of it and to use that soldier humour and change people's mindset and make them think differently and... you know, convince them that what they're doing is the right thing and to carry on doing what they're doing.
After Herrick 16, you became the Academy Sergeant Major.
Yeah.
After that, the Army Sergeant Major.
Yeah.
Was that a new role in 2015?
Yeah, so the Academy Sergeant Major used to be the senior Sergeant Major position in the Army. We just never had an Army Sergeant Major like many other armies around the world. So when I was the Academy Sergeant Major, although people would like you to travel around with CGS, the Chief of the General Staff, and have an idea of what's going on in the Army, you just haven't. All you know is what's going on in Sandhurst. So the Chief of the General Staff at the time, General Nick Carter, decided to have an Army Sergeant Major, which was a completely new thing. It kind of came out of nowhere, and it had... lots of naysayers and blockers against it and people that didn't believe in it and wondered why we would do it because it was seen as an American idea. Why do we need to do that? We've had an army for 350 years. Why do we need to change it now and bring in such a senior position? And CGS at the time stuck to his guns, asked my advice, and he, at the same time of bringing the Army Sergeant Major job, and he brought in he sort of changed the concept and the network of command sergeant majors at the time, which we kind of had, but we didn't necessarily do it properly. So the new job came in, I was appointed into it for a 3-year position, and it was a real challenge to set it up.
What was it?
So the Army Sergeant Major was the senior warrant officer in the Army, based out of Army headquarters, and essentially I was appointed as a member of ECAB, which was the Executive Committee of the Army Board. So if you can imagine a table full of generals and a couple of civil servants and maybe some outsiders that set the policy for the British Army, I was brought into that as somebody with very limited experience in running a business and understanding how this sort of stuff works, I was plonked around this table. So it was a real baptism of fire. I was uncomfortable to start off with, and it took me the best part of 8, 9, 10 months to really understand how I could influence this room. And it wasn't just that. It wasn't just being sat around this board table. It was also about working out what I had to do, because setting up a role at that senior is quite hard to do. You've got to work out what your job remit is and how you can make a difference. So it took me a long time to get around the army and to convince people that this role was a good thing and to tell people exactly what it was for. And, you know, I soon started to find out that seeing is believing. And when people saw you and heard you and listened to what you had to say and what you were trying to do, then they understood it, and then they got behind you, and then they supported you. And then before you knew it, the Army Sergeant Major role was taken off. The problem was there was many people in the chain of command, both up and down, that were, one, jealous of the access that the Army Sergeant Major would get. And they felt threatened by the influence that the Army Sergeant Major could have to the senior levels of the Army. Mm. Because the influence was unbelievable. You know, I was probably the only person that could have an open door policy with the head of the Army that could walk in when I wanted to and say, "Sir, I need to speak to you about something." But I don't think people really understood that.
And what was you influencing then? Things like transition? Was it all about those that are serving?
I mean, there's so much to do. If I can just give you an idea. So that if you think about all the officers that are sat around that executive board table, most of them will be probably 15 to 20 years removed from those at the coalface. That will be the last time they kind of commanded as a commanding officer. So they've been away from it a long time. They are genuinely good people that care passionately about the army they serve. But the problem is they haven't got, other than the staff that work for them, they haven't got anyone that really gets out on the ground that can feed them unfiltered information. Mm. So that's what I did. I would influence them in a way only that a sergeant major could influence them, with honesty, with frank, clear, factual advice, with no hidden agenda, on a number of things. And I mean, it's hard to list them all. It's hard to list exactly what influence you had, but just things such as education. I'm passionate about soldiers' education. You know, I had no education when I joined, and I'm passionate now about other ranks. And in my new job I'm in now across the services, but changing the command leadership and management, bringing in chartered management and degree apprenticeships for serving personnel. The Army leadership was rolled out, and I played a big part in that as the champion for Army leadership. In influencing how it was written and how it was developed and how we could change behaviours in the army for the better. Communications was a big thing. So no one had really had any social media accounts at the time. So for me to come in and set up an official Twitter account and other things that I tried and failed for a number of reasons, it just changed the way the army... It wasn't down to me. It was the position that managed to change the way we communicated and the way we showed... the changes that were being made. And I think it's just grown from there, with senior people and junior people now jumping on the communication sort of bandwagon and making a difference. And then everything from diversity and inclusion and women in ground close combat, bullying, harassment, discrimination, you know, alcohol abuse, mental health, well-being. There were so many things. And as the Army Sergeant Major, you just need to know a little about a lot. And you need to spread yourself thinly, and you need to just try and, because you are not a union chairman, you are not someone that's going to go against the grain. You've got to complement the chain of command. Mm. You are employed by that chain of command to do a job, and you've got to cleverly do it in a way that only a sergeant major can do it.
And actually, long term, you know, influence is one thing, but if you look at the long game, and this might be a 20, 30, or yeah. You know, you just... exponentially, you know, it just goes on.
Yeah,
you can't just do everything straight away. You have to be able to, especially when you've got pushback from certain people, you've got to be able just to go, oh, this is a bit of influence, let's start it. And then you almost, you know, like the New Zealand rugby union team, you know, you have the shirt and you want to pass the shirt on.
Yeah.
In a better position than when you got it. And I think it's a really good kind of mantra, that of how to go from it. And it, you know, like Rome won't build it in a day.
Exactly.
And these things do take time. And we mentioned communication. I feel like, especially on things like Twitter, that it's really open now, and me looking really from outside back into it, but a big link that I'm seeing things that I've never seen before, and just having been able to communicate with people, whether that's, you know, heads of the military, yeah, right the way through to civil servants, and I'm having meaningful conversations with people, especially around the podcast and the stuff we're doing with employment and all the rest of it. But it has its negatives as well, social media, and you, I personally believe unjustly, you were getting hammered a lot on various platforms. And not to go into that too much, but that did have a negative impact on your well-being.
Yeah.
To the point where you broke down.
Yeah, so I, as I said before, you know, I've always prided myself on being a machine, because that's what, you know, that's how I've grown up. And I've, you know, I've always been proud of the fact that, you know, I think I'm a bit of a tough guy and I'm mentally resilient and I can handle most things, et cetera, et cetera. Been on operations, seen all the bad stuff, done all that sort of thing. But then when I got in the army, so I made your position, it was almost like a concoction of things all at once. I decided as well when I was in that job to study and do a degree, because I wanted to try and set an example to others that you can educate yourself, you know, later on in life, which I successfully did. But, you know, that sort of came at a cost as well, because I was extremely busy trying to set this job up. I was traveling a lot, visiting the army. I was away from home a lot. I set up these social media accounts, and yeah, I got a fair amount of stick on social media. Whether it was personal or not, I don't know. And I thought I was doing pretty well with it. And, you know, I chose who to engage with, and I continued and battled on and tried to do the right thing for people and for the organisation and kept persevering. I had no idea. I knew I was busy. I knew I was, you know, not stressed, but I knew I was wired, if that makes sense.
Manic.
Yeah, manic. And I was working really hard, but I was pleased to be working hard because I like being busy and I like trying to make a difference. And then one day I just happened to go to the doctor's, military doctor, and I went for something like an ankle or a knee. I can't remember what it was. And the doctor then started probing, asking questions like doctors do about how you're sleeping and stuff like that. And I was sleeping horrifically, so nothing stops me going to sleep. You know, I get blow darted at 2200 every night, and I'm out for the count, no matter where I am or what I'm doing. But I'd be a 0-3 waker upper, stressor, writing things down, thinking about what I've got to do, reading social media, thinking about the next tweet, all this sort of stuff. He picked up on that and asked me a few other questions. But anyway, the conversation went on, and I just broke down with the doctor, like properly broke down and squealed like I'd never cried and squealed since I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And it's almost like everything was just pent up inside me, waiting to get out. And he, because he's a brilliant doctor, he just got it out of me. Yeah, it was a tough time. It's tough when you pride yourself on being somebody who you think you are, to then be seen like that by a doctor, and then to share everything with them was just a bit of a challenge. And then to then, you know, share that with my wife and my family as well, was a tough pill to swallow.
Mm. Was you diagnosed with anything?
Yeah, it was depression, stress, sort of related stuff. I was offered meds, which it was almost like a release as well. Once it happened, I was kind of over the moon it had happened. I didn't know it was there, and I didn't know I wanted to release it, but when I released it, it was just an amazing feeling. And then I got put on some meds, not for overly long. I was recommended to do counselling, which I refused. I didn't want to do it because there was still an element in me that said, I don't need it. I'll be fine now I know what's wrong, and now I've got some medication, and now I've got a doctor to talk to who was absolutely brilliant, and I confided in for the months afterwards. It all worked out okay. And from that, it just changed my mindset completely. It changed me as a human being. It's made me do things now I never would have thought I'd do. And it's made me want to help other people that are perhaps in the same position.
Mm. The next role on from that, so you handed over that role of Army Sergeant Major, and you became the Senior Enlisted Advisor. So essentially you're working now with and for the MOD.
Yeah.
You're removed from the Army as such. And we're looking at things like recruitment and retention and retirement. And I know that's a big part of what you're trying to go into there. But off the back of that, the Mental Health Champion has come about.
Yeah.
That it's a new role, certainly seen by many as progressive and a really good step forward from and then with words and phrases like mental resilience that have crept in over the years and mental fitness. And an onus on management of good mental health. What is the role, firstly, of the kind of the Senior Enlisted Advisor, and then your kind of sub role as the Mental Health Champion?
Yeah, so the Senior Enlisted Advisor to the Chiefs of Staff Committee. I mean, it's a long winded title, but I think it's a good thing that it's not called Defence Sergeant Major or Defence Warrant Officer, because as soon as you use words like that, you think of a shouty bloke with a stick that's telling people to pick up rubbish or sort out car parking. So I think Senior Enlisted Advisor to the Chiefs of Staff Committee is good. And so in the role, I advise the Chief of Defence Staff, Chief Defence People, Defence Ministers, and the Service Chiefs. With the help of the service warrant officers as well. So it's a pretty widespread sort of job. I do advise. I do pretty much, it's just a bigger scale of the Army Sergeant Major job, but I've got the other services to think about as well. So because I know the Army intimately, I've kind of stayed away from the Army for the last sort of 8 months of getting into this job, and I've learned a huge amount from the Navy and the Royal Air Force and the civil service. And there is, honestly, there is so much good stuff in each service that we could learn from each other. And I see the SEAC role, and that's the abbreviation for the job, the SEAC, as one of the only people that can get around about the whole of defence and try and bring the cloths of defence together with good ideas and share experiences. So I work out of the Ministry of Defence in London. I travel a lot and get out and about and try and learn as much as I can about the services. But essentially, many people have heard me say this before, I try to be three things, and that's a thermometer to check the temperature and, you know, the way of life around defence. I'm a translator because I try and translate the language from the very senior levels all the way down to a language that you and I understand, normal human beings speak. And I'm a courier because I can deliver from the very senior levels right down to the most junior and then back up from the junior up to the senior. So it's a unique role. And I use social media heavily to try and do that and to try and message and to try and bring those cloths of defence together. And I work very closely with the service warrant officers because the Army, the Navy, the Air Force and the Marines have each got their own senior warrant officer that do most of the work with their own networks. And they feed that into me. And I use the information from the very lowest levels and feed it all the way up to the top. So, you know, people, again, there was naysayers, blockers, non-believers, people that felt threatened and jealous. But now it's in 8 months in, people have seen a difference already. And the Mental Health and Wellbeing Champion was just an idea. I happened to speak to a few people and said, you know, I kind of can't believe that the military haven't got a champion. And when I say champion, I don't, you know, I'm no doctor. I'm no expert in mental health, far from it. And, you know, what's really triggered this is my own experience that we've just talked through, made me just want to do something and try and help people. That's literally what I'm trying to do in all of these roles. This isn't about, genuinely isn't about Glenn Horton. I've got nowhere else to go. This isn't about a hidden agenda. It's about these roles helping the people that they serve. Mm. And that's what it's about. And the Mental Health and Wellbeing Champion is literally there to raise awareness, to break down barriers, to break down the stigma, to signpost people, to let people know it's all right to talk. And if someone that's 6'4", looks like me with a bald head and tattoos and, you know, thinks they're the alpha male, it can happen to anybody. And it's my job to convince them it's okay to share and to talk. And then there is somewhere for them to go to help them.
Mm. I mean, the role or that, what is it a role? Yeah,
it's a role. It's an appointment. Role? Yeah, it's an official
role.
So
that will go on to someone else after you.
Yeah, so my, you know, people say to me, what do you want to achieve in this first year? And the first thing I say is to make this role irreversible. I want it to be a one-way valve. The SEAC needs to stay because it's a position that can represent the views, not just of enlisted and other ranks, but everybody in defence. It gives defence ministers and chiefs a completely different perspective and a view.
And the mental health and well-being champion, will that always be part of the advisors?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I will advise to do, yeah. So yeah. I think it's... Because the unique thing about these positions is because I've been one of the boys and girls, they listen in a different way to they'll listen to a four-star general. Because you've been there and you've lived it and you've done all the ranks and you've been through what they've been through. And because you communicate in a way that most of them understand and they can relate to, it's almost like in most cases they trust the position more than anything else. So it's a good position to be in to influence the way we do our business.
A great step forward. Glenn, we will leave it there.